Welcome to Beekeeping Today Podcast, presented by Bee Culture. Beekeeping Today Podcast is your source for beekeeping news, information, and entertainment. I'm Jeff Ott.
And I'm Kim Flatham.
Hey, Jeff and Kim. Today's sponsor is Global Patties. They're a family-operated business that manufactures protein supplement patties for honeybees. It's a good time to think about honeybee nutrition. Feeding your hive's protein supplement patties will ensure that they produce strong and healthy colonies by increasing brood production and overall honey flow. Now is a great time to consider what type of patty is right for your area and your honeybees. Global offers a variety of standard patties as well as custom patties to meet your needs. No matter where you are, Global is ready to serve you out of their manufacturing plants in Airdrie, Alberta, and in Butte, Montana, or from distribution depots across the continent. Visit them today at www.globalpatties.com.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sherry. We really appreciate our sponsor support. They make all of this happen and provide us the ability to expand and grow, as you'll see in the coming months. With that, thanks to Bee Culture Magazine for continuing their presenting sponsorship of this podcast. Bee Culture has been the magazine for American beekeeping since 1873. Subscribe to Bee Culture today. And while you're there, check out Bee Culture's Beekeeping Your First 3 Years, a quarterly magazine for beginning beekeepers. We also want to thank 2 Million Blossoms as sponsor of this episode. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinators. Learn more in our Season 2, Episode 9 podcast with editor and guest co-host Kirsten Trainer and from visiting www.2millionblossoms.com. And that is with a number 2. Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us. Happy holidays. We're glad you're here because we got another great episode lined up for you today. Hey, Kim, happy holidays. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, it was a good day. Quiet, of course, not a lot of company, but we cooked dinner for all of our family that's close by and delivered it to them. So we got to wave through the window and they got to eat.
Oh, very good. It sounds like a great... You didn't stop over here, though.
Yeah, I was thinking of it, but I ran out of food first.
Hey, so there's a lot of things a beekeeper could be doing right now, and I was thinking about that the last couple of days because we've had actually some nice weather here in Olympia, and thinking, what should I be doing with my bees right now? And one of the things that always plagues me is every year, this time of year, is what do I do with all my equipment that's no longer on the beehive so that it's useful next year? So let's spend a couple minutes talking about that.
Well, you know, Jeff, this past year has changed that problem dramatically with the reintroduction of Sertan, the bacillus bacteria that you spray on your combs, mm-hmm. and you can store them, and wax moth are history. You don't have to cover them. You don't have to protect them. A good dose of Sertan, it's not free. But neither are combs. So yeah. Sertan has changed how we store equipment. No matter whether you live in the tropics or you live up in the frigid north where I am, dark and warm enough and I'll get wax moth damage a little bit every mm-hmm. year. Traditionally, it's been, you know, once it freezes, you don't have to worry about it. And you know, I store the stuff in my unheated garage, so I don't have a problem. But it's before it freezes and then after spring, you know, after spring starts and it's warming up again, if there's larva eggs in there or wax moth eggs in there, boom, I got a problem. Yeah. So Sertan has changed the picture dramatically.
And you can use that on brood and stored honey supers and frames?
Everything.
And that's safe.
If it's a beeswax, it gets sprayed.
Wow.
And there's no contamination problems. There's no issues with the bees problems. It lasts essentially all winter. It remains active all because it's in a spore format. Mm-hmm. So it's made life simpler.
So you said it's back. So was it gone for a while and they brought it back for some reason?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Yep. They didn't want to. Well, their new registration came up, and nobody wanted to pick it up. A lot of effort for not a lot of return was sort of the argument of the day, and that was back, I don't know, 6 or 7, 10 years ago, whenever it was. And the folks in Canada, I want to say VITA, picked it up. They renewed it for Canada and the U.S., and now you can get it.
So that takes care of wax moth damage, but you still have to worry about mice and rats and stored equipment, don't you?
There is. Yep. that hasn't gone away. And you know, there's two things to do for that primarily. One of them is, you know, put them in a secure place if that's possible. My unheated garage is not a secure place, but I have rat bait in my garage starting about the 4th of July, and I don't have a rodent problem in my garage, but I start early. That's the key. You put it out now, you know, they're going to find your frames, mm-hmm. and then they'll find the bait, and then they'll go away probably. But if they don't find the bait, you still got some damage. So if you start early, you get rid of them early.
I've been, well, you know me, if it's electronic and it's a gadget, I like to mess around with that. And I've started using these electronic rat and mouse zappers, and they're very effective. You put a little peanut butter in the back, and they have to walk across two metal plates, and then zap, and they're dead. And you just empty the tray, and it's gone. It's a little bit better.
Really?
Yeah, they're expensive, though. I mean, for rats, it's like $50 a trap. But the batteries last for, I don't know, many, many, many kills. And, you know, it's I'm always a little cautious about spreading poison around and rat baits, because we have cats and other critters and hawks and stuff. And I'm always concerned about the effects of the poison on the animals. So this has worked out to be a real good alternative. And they have a size for rats and size for mice, too.
Where can I get one of those? I'm going to have to look into that.
You can get those any of those big box stores, Lowe's, Home Depot, and Amazon sells them. It's pretty interesting. They're very effective.
And it's an electronic rat killer.
Yeah, it looks like a small, just a small box with a one-way in and two metal plates in the bottom and place for batteries. And they crawl in, they get zapped. So it's worked out pretty nicely. Well, what else can a beekeeper be doing this time of year? There's, you know, I'm looking at next year and I'm thinking about what next season's going to bring. What do you suggest?
Well, of course, Jeff, one of the things that I know I'm going to bet every beekeeper at this time of year, sometime in their beekeeping career, goes, should I be getting bigger next year? You know, can I expand this? I had a pretty good year this year. I kept grow under control. Mostly it was a lot of work, but it worked. And I made enough honey to pay all my bills and help out at home. And I actually had a good time and a good year this year. Maybe I should be thinking about expanding. So what does that mean? Selling queens in packages, getting them from somebody? Maybe getting some manufacturers supply chain so that you can be selling from any of the many manufacturers. How do I let people know about that? It comes down to a good business plan.
Yeah.
Every time, a good business plan. And I'm going to tell you, no matter what you're thinking of doing next year, talk to five beekeepers and see what you get. You're going to get five different answers, but the more people you talk to, the more advice you'll have to choose from. If you're going on what you're thinking about sitting in your chair at night watching television, you're going to miss 2/3 of what you need to know. So mm-hmm. if you're thinking of doing anything next year different, talk to 5 or 10 or 50 beekeepers and see what kind of advice you get and where it might lead you.
It would also be good to talk to beekeepers who are doing the type of beekeeping you want to do, whether they've been moving their bees to almond pollination, or they're just staying local and doing local pollination, or just are they producing for honey, that type of thing. You don't want to talk to someone who's doing something a little bit different than what you want to do.
Well, I don't know. You know, you bring up a good point. If I'm sitting on a couple hundred colonies, do I need to be thinking about almonds? And maybe I do. You know, maybe I can be working with 3 other beekeepers and we can put together a semi-load, or I can be working with one other beekeeper who's taking his own bees out from the Midwest or ever. Like I said, the more people you talk to, the more ideas you'll get and the more experience you'll be able to draw on to see what might work, what might not work for your operation, you, you and your family and your bees.
Well, very good. Develop different types of partnerships.
Well, Jeff, I'm going to just be perfectly honest here. It's a little bit of self-promotion. There's a book out there called In Business with Bees, and I wrote that book exactly to answer this question. And there's a lot. I've talked to thousands of beekeepers over the years. I've had the rare opportunity to be in a position to talk to 20 people every day I go to work if I wanted to. And I've made notes. So a lot of what is in that book comes from not me. It comes from a lot of the people that I talked to over the years. And the nice thing about being around as long as I was, I can go back and take a look at what the guy 20 years ago told me. Is he still in business? Has he thrived? Has he been successful? Or is he not in the picture anymore? So what does that mean about the information that he gave me? So I've been able to draw on a long line of beekeepers over a long time to see what's been successful.
Kind of a new slant on Darwinian beekeeping.
In a way, Darwinian beekeepers.
That's right, Darwinian beekeepers. And you know, interest, and that is a great book. I have it. There's some very good practical information that any beekeeper looking to expand their operation will find in that. So I highly recommend that from our own author here, Kim Flottam. But speaking of, you know, you mentioned something there that intrigues me. Interviews with beekeepers. What a great segue.
Yeah, that's great. Steve Donahoe has done a good job on this book. He, too, has done basically the same thing as I was reading his book. He's talked to a lot of people over a lot of years and sees what's worked, what's not worked, what's similar and what's not similar on commercial beekeepers all over the world.
All right. Well, before we hear from Steve, let's hear from one of our sponsors, Strong Microbials.
Hello, beekeepers. Your honeybees face a lot of challenges out there. Unbalanced food sources for monoculture crops, holding yards, drought, food shortages, antibiotics, pesticides, and pathogens like chalk brood. To overcome these challenges, your bees need the multiple bacteria that are in all nectars, pollens, and the environment. These bacteria aid honeybees' digestion and improve your honeybees' response and resilience to pesticides. Now you can help improve your honey colony health with a quick, easy, and safe-to-use product. Strong Microbials Super DFM Honeybee uses naturally occurring bacteria to restore the healthy gut biome of your honeybees. Check them out today at www.strongmicrobials.com.
Hey, Steve, thanks for joining us on Beekeeping Today podcast. We're glad you're here.
It's very nice of you to welcome me to your show.
Oh, you bet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's good to have a face with a name, Steve. I spent a lot of time reading your book, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Oh, thank you.
So it's good to be able to chat about it a little bit. And I've got to ask you, how did you manage to pull this off? You just got in a plane and took off one day?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was quite lucky in that I had the time and I had the money, having sold a business a few years earlier. I love beekeeping, but the hard thing is to actually get hold of these people, because I wanted to talk to basically my heroes, the big beekeepers that I'd heard about but hadn't really met. My logic being that if they've been beekeeping for sort of 40 years and they've been successful and they've grown and they've probably handled thousands of colonies of bees every year, they must be the people to talk to. And I was I think I'd been beekeeping about 7 or 8 years when I started this project. So that will show in my questions, because I think if I was a more experienced beekeeper, I may have asked slightly different questions. And if I was a complete beginner, I would definitely have asked different questions. But anyway, the hard thing is just getting hold of these guys and getting them to agree to see me. And then they never want to talk to you in the summer. It's always in the winter when they're...
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And the biggest break for me really was getting hold of Mike Palmer, excuse me, because he was... He was the first, and because he was quite well known, I could, after that, I could say, oh, well, Mike Palmer's in the book, so do you want to join him? And it was a bit easier after that.
So what was the genesis of the idea? What made you think one day you'd go out and interview beekeepers from around the world and tell their stories?
I'd got bored. It sounds terrible, this, but I had got bored of reading the normal beekeeping book because, I mean, there must be wonderful beekeeping books out there, but and I know Kim's written a few of them, but when you've read, you know, this is a hive, this is a bee, this is swarming, this is, you know, they all seem a bit the same. And so I was kind of, but yet when you meet a beekeeper and you talk to them about bees, it's always really interesting. Everyone's got something to say, you know, so the idea was, well, I can't find this book. I want to read this book, but it doesn't exist. So maybe I'll just write it myself.
One of the people you were talking to had some really good advice, and I don't remember which one of the people, but what he said was, this is, if you want to learn, talk to as many people as you possibly can. And I couldn't agree more with that. If you're not out finding out what other people are doing, you become isolated, and you know, bad habits just get worse. So I thought, who was that said that? Do you remember?
Oh dear. Yeah. No, I can't remember. But the thing I've come across is that some people think, why would I listen to a beekeeper in Canada or America or New Zealand? You know, I'm sat here in the UK. What's that got to do with me? And to some extent, they're right, because obviously everyone's got different conditions, and beekeeping does vary. But I mean, why wouldn't you listen to someone who's like Randy Oliver or Ray Oliveras or Mike Palmer? You know, they must have some wisdom there that's worth listening to, and I believe that there are subtle differences because of the climate and what have you. But basically, it's the same insect, isn't it? It's the honeybee, and it goes through the same sort of cycles throughout the year. So I think you can learn from anyone.
I think the three people you just named are probably as different from each other as they are from you in the UK, because although Ray Oliveras and Randy Oliver are in Northern California, what they do and how they do it is vastly different. And then Mike Palmer, of course, is over on the East Coast in Vermont. He has winter. They don't. So putting the three together, you got a good, not total, but a good overview, I think, of commercial beekeeping in the U.S.
Yeah, I wanted to travel. And as I said, I had the time and I could afford it for a while. So I wasn't going to pass up on the chance of visiting places like California, which I'd heard so much about. And, you know, you see these things on the movies and what have you. So I wanted to see it for myself, really. But the thing is, what I found is that I don't really like cities that much. So all the kind of the glamorous type stuff that goes on in, I don't know, San Francisco or wherever, I find myself sat in a hotel in a city not really being that comfortable. But when I got out into the northern, like Northern California or out into Vermont, looking at the forest and, you know, the countryside, I feel a lot more at home there.
Well, I think that reflects a lot of beekeepers. Most of us don't live in cities. No. You know, the two people that you talk to that are, what's the phrase, are probably the best known in terms of having being out in the public. Randy Oliver, of course, with his webpage and his writing in the American Bee Journal, and Murray McGregor.
I wondered if you would know about him.
Well, he's on social media all over the place, and so I've gotten to know him secondhand, more or less. But those are the two people that really stood out in terms of being well known by probably more beekeepers than some of these others. And the good person you've talked to in France, I had never heard of, so that was good too, because the other people I've heard of or mostly heard of, and it was. Fascinating. The fellow who worked with Brother Adam, that must have been a treat and a half.
Yeah, I mean, that was a long time ago. That was in the mid-60s to the mid-70s, I think. But he was basically the main beekeeping assistant, Brother Adam, for about 10 years at Buckfast Abbey. So even though it was a long time ago, when you talk to him, that's what he keeps... He easily recalls those days, and he you know, you can tell that he loved. That was probably one of the best times of his life.
Well, it goes without saying. I think that it was yeah. Well done. It was fascinating to read.
Yeah, he had nice photographs as well, which I tried to get some of them in the book, but obviously I couldn't put them all in. And the guy in France, Richard Knoll, he was interesting because he's just gone commercial, but at the time I interviewed him, he was just stepping up. So I think he had about 200 hives. And he had another job as well. And it was interesting to see how somebody moves from just being a biggish beekeeper to making their living from it. And it turned out that the previous year he'd gone to visit Mike Palmer and worked with him for a while, and that was part of the decision-making process that, you know, he said, right, yeah, I'm going to go for it.
Well, he picked a good teacher, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And the person who packs honey in New Zealand, how was that?
Well, that was a bit of a shock, really, because I knew I wanted to go to New Zealand, but I don't know very much about New Zealand beekeeping. And all I knew, of course, was Manuka, Manuka, Manuka. That's all you ever hear about. But anyway, I found this guy, Peter Bray. He's a long-standing beekeeping family in New Zealand. I think his father and grandfather were all, you know, I think it was his grandfather that set the company up. But I flew out all the way out to New Zealand and went to meet him, and I had all these questions about beekeeping, and he's not even a beekeeper. He was a beekeeper. He used to have about 6,000 hives, but many years ago he decided that was too much like hard work, and he specializes now in packing and marketing honey, and they've got some clever stuff that I mean, it's a good company and they're doing well. But that threw me a little, because I had to just throw my questions in the bin and wing it, really.
Well, you did a good job, because he came out well on that, and it was good. It was fun to read, because I've been there and got to travel around the whole North Island for a couple of weeks. So it was sort of kind of like going home again. It was a nice place to remember. I'll go back to Randy Oliver and Ray Oliveras. Ray's got one big operation.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's and what time of the year were you there?
October.
So he wasn't actively raising queens, at least there.
It was kind of a quiet time. But the big thing for people in that, well, like, I don't know, it might be all the way across America, but certainly California, it's just making sure they're strong through the winter, isn't it, so that they can be ready for the almond pollination.
Yeah, and dodging fires out there this year. Both of them were close.
Well, when I was there, I stayed in Chico in Northern California just for one night, and then I drove across to Grass Valley where Randy is, and that I think 2 weeks later that was the is it called the Paradise Fire?
Yes.
And that was a terrible thing, but I mean I only missed it by 2 weeks. It just seems to be getting worse every year.
That's been a trying year for beekeepers. I don't know if you've ever seen a bee yard after a fire goes through. The only thing you got is nails left. It's a tough way to go out of business, I guess. And then you'd also talked to three folks in the UK. And how alike were they and how unalike were they?
Well, as you've mentioned Murray McGregor, and he's, as far as I know, he's the biggest commercial beekeeper in the UK, which seems strange to me because he's in Scotland. And I thought, it's cold and wet. How the hell can you be the biggest beekeeper in the UK up there? But turns out that he does very well, and he's got endless hills covered in heather.
Yeah.
He keeps bees on the land that's owned by the Queen as well, on the Balmoral Estate. But he has access to endless hills of heather, and so that's his main crop. Not compared to you guys over there, but for us, he's big. He's got about 4,000 colonies now, and he moves boxes around a lot, which is something that... In the UK, that's what we think about American beekeepers. We think American beekeepers are always moving their boxes. And there's quite a lot of people say, oh, it's not so good for the bees and what have you. And he's a bit like that. You know, he has to move bees to a wintering site. Then in spring, he moves them to spring sites. And then he has to move them in the late summer for the heather. But he's a lovely guy, and this is the thing I found about all the commercial beekeepers. They're down to earth. They love bees. They love nature. They don't just love bees. I mean, they love every little critter. They know the names of all the birds and all the insects and the wildlife. I mean, they're proper country people, which isn't the image you always hear about commercial beekeepers. You often hear that they're exploiting the bees and they're only in it for the money, and I found that to be completely wrong. The other guy in the UK was Peter Little. He's got a sort of Brother Adam connection because he has access to the old mating station that Brother Adam had on Dartmoor, so he's a really high, you know, I'd say he's one of the best queen breeders in the UK. He controls, you know, he doesn't just open mate bees. He does a lot of instrumental insemination. And as I say, he's got that isolated mating station on Dartmoor that Brother Adam used. But he was a really interesting guy because he's so into self-sufficiency. He makes everything. So he makes his own beehives. He has a sawmill. Makes his own wax foundation. He has a press to do that. Everything. I mean, he when I saw him last, he was making a machine that dries honey. You know, if the honey's got too much water in it, it takes the water off. But he would never buy one. He would just look at one, see how it works, and then make it.
Yeah. How alike was his operation and Ray Oliveira's?
Completely different.
Completely. Different. Yet they both are raising queens.
Yeah, it's amazing. I met Ray and his wife Tammy and I think a couple of their kids. I think when I arrived, they were just having a business meeting. I think I got there a bit early, and so I met them and sort of half interrupted their board meeting or whatever. But luckily, I'd taken them a gift. I took them a bottle of mead. But they're a family business, which for the scale of the operation, I found that really nice that they were still, it's kind of everyone in the family's got a role. And in many ways, they treat their workers as part of the family. They have kind of barbecues on a Friday afternoon, and it's a kind of a family business type feel, even though they're massive.
Did you get to go to their restaurant?
No.
Oh, they have a restaurant downtown that's amazing to visit. Good food and good people. But the other thing is at the Oliveras, I actually get my queens and my bees from him here in Ohio. He has a truck that he sends all the way to the East Coast. That's environmentally controlled inside. It's got GPS and he knows where the truck is every minute of the day. And the bees arrive in their perfect shape because the temperature's been right and the ventilation's been right. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you got to see that, but if you didn't, it's too bad because it's really a what's the word, Jeff? It's a technological masterpiece, yeah, in terms of keeping bees alive. It's well done. Well, what was the one thing, Steve, if you were going to sit back and fold your hands and think for a minute and say, if I had to say there's a couple of things or maybe one thing that all of these people kind of had in common, and maybe you've already said it in terms of how they observe nature and are aware. What did you say? They're good country people, I think. But if you were going to say in terms of the beekeeping business, if you want to be a successful beekeeper, here's one or two things to keep in mind, because all of these guys were kind of hit going in that direction. Or maybe there isn't something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there were definitely, when I asked if somebody was thinking of going into the business, what would you recommend? They nearly all replied with the same thing, which is don't just jump in, don't just throw all your money at this thing, but start slow, learn, maybe work for another beekeeper, but certainly don't quit the day job. That was a common thing. And many of them said, you can get a year that makes you look like a fantastic beekeeper because the weather's perfect and everything happened and you didn't really have to do anything. And then you can get another year when you just look like a complete fool. And another thing about going commercial is you really do need to have a good business plan and think about all the costs, the trucks and the honey house and all that sort of thing. The main things that people always talk about Varroa mites. And I know Randy Oliver at the time I met him, he was doing a field trial, looking at the drifting of worker bees in around about this sort of time of the year, collapsing colonies, and he had tagged these bees with well, actually he didn't do it, his assistant did it, but she stuck these little magnetic discs on the back of all these bees, different colored discs, and he could track where they drifted to because there was a magnetic bar on the entrance to other hives. And it was quite surprising how far they go. He hadn't finished when I was there, but it was around about half a mile to a mile was the main kind of zone that they were drifting to. But yeah, I know he's got a big effort to try and make a bee that's a good honeybee, but also can cope with Varroa mites. Most beekeepers I talked to about that said that would be great, but we haven't got that yet, and therefore I'm going to treat my bees, which I kind of completely understand, because if you don't treat your bees and you lose 80% of them, you haven't really got much of a business left. But one day I think it would be lovely if we do get to a varroa-resistant honeybee. I think that's the way it has to go, really, because you can't just keep throwing chemicals at the thing, can you? But, varroa was a big one. Nutrition was a big one, something I'd never considered, but because I live in the UK, we have pollen all the time. We never run out of pollen. We never have to use supplements. The honeybee is common across the world. It's actually a European. It came from the European sort of zone, like the Italian bee is very common, isn't it? I think that's the main kind of subspecies in New Zealand and probably in America. I'm not sure. They evolved in a certain area with certain plants, and in somewhere like New Zealand, you have completely different plants. So the pollen isn't always quite what they need, and they may be missing things. So that was something I hadn't really considered. But obviously, pollen is a massively important thing for a bee colony.
You mentioned varroa. That's the thread that all of these people, except the packer in New Zealand, and even him to a degree, that's the thread that ties them all together, because everybody has to deal with it. How do you deal with varroa in your operation?
Well, I'm only small. I've only got 40-odd hives, and I'm not, I hope I've learned off these guys, but I know I've got a long way to go. But I play it safe. I've just given them Apivar strips, and in the winter I do oxalic acid when they're broodless. That more or less does it. If I do an oxalic treatment in the winter when they're broodless, that will get me all the way through until about August time. Well, that's when the mite load starts going up again, and then I give them Apivar, which is Amitraz.
Well, it sounds like you got a pretty robust program there, but then you have to, or you don't have bees.
Well, Peter Little was telling me the other day that he's noticed resistance to Amitraz now in some of his colonies, saying they seem to positively love the stuff. It wasn't killing them at all. So that's the next thing, isn't it? What do you do if you can't use Amitraz?
Steve, what have we missed that you want to mention about your book?
One of the things that I sort of touch on in the introduction is just about the kind of, I don't know if you could call it therapeutic effect, but I came from a business background, very high stress. I was a workaholic. I drank too much. I was a stressed out guy. I was struggling really. And something that I found from doing beekeeping, which might sound a bit odd, but just sticking your hands in a beehive, you just get lost, don't you? You just you forget all your troubles, and all you're thinking about is how amazing these bees are, and you're trying to figure out what they're doing, and there's the smells, and it's a wonderful thing. So I've found that beekeeping is actually really a therapeutic thing for me. I mean, there are times when it's quite stressful too, when they're all trying to swarm, for example. But it just gets me away. It gets me away from myself. It gets me into it's almost like meditation, really. So I don't want to get too hocus pocus about it, but
well, a lot of people have gone through exactly what you just described, which is why they ended up keeping bees. So you're not alone in that thing.
Yeah.
So what we've got is the book Interviews with Beekeepers by Steve Donahoe. Where can I get the book, Steve?
It's available on online stores. That's probably your best bet rather than, there might be some big stores that stock it, but you'll definitely get it online almost anywhere.
You've got it on your webpage too, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a webpage, but if you wanted a signed book, you'd have to go to my website, which is interviewswithbeekeepers.com. And it might be a bit expensive to send one out to the States, but I'll happily do that if someone wants to pay the postage. But if you don't want it signed, then anywhere really.
Yeah, we'll have that web link on there in the show notes for anybody who wants a signed copy.
Okay.
It'd be really good.
I've got a blog as well called The Walrus and the Honeybee. I'm the walrus, and it's gone quite well. That's probably been going about 3 years, and got a few followers. And yeah, I mean, as long as people keep visiting, then I'll keep writing it. And it's good fun.
Well, I took a quick look. It was fun to read. So if you're yeah. looking for something to do, folks, take a look at his blog. It's it'll give you a good feeling for quite a while. Steve, I think that about wraps us up.
Okay.
We appreciate you being here today. And Interviews with Beekeepers by Steve Donahoe. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Steve had some great insight and had some great interviews. That would be great just to jump on a plane and go visit beekeepers around the world.
Yeah, don't I wish. and in light of that, since that's not going to happen probably much anymore, he did talk to some good people. He had good examples of people running very different kinds of businesses. And what we were talking about earlier was talk to as many people as you can. Talk to people who have been successful. Find out what they, you know, all the people he talked to had some things in common. Mm-hmm. And it was talking to as many people as you can. Have a good business plan. Let me repeat that. Have a good business plan. Work for other beekeepers and pay attention. And your chances of success go way, way up.
And when we talk about business plans for beekeepers, we're not talking about 20-page documents. We're talking about just a solid outline of where you want to be in 12 months, where you want to be in 24 months. And leave it at that as a starting point. Define your scope of business and where you want to be.
And then measure it. That's the key. I wrote it down. Did it happen? Did it not happen? And why? One more thing, Jeff. I want to remind our listeners, or I want to tell our listeners, that there's a new podcast coming out sometime later this winter. Jim, too, and I have gotten together, and we've put together some pretty good information in an interesting format. And stay tuned. It's coming up soon this winter.
That's great. Yeah, that's going to be a great podcast, and I look forward to the continuation of the Kim and Jim show, but in a new format.
Yep.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this podcast. Before we go, I want to encourage our listeners to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, wherever you download and stream the show. Your vote helps other beekeepers find us quicker. Even better, write a review and let other beekeepers looking for a new podcast know what you like. As always, we thank Bee Culture, the magazine for American beekeeping, for their continued support of Beekeeping Today podcast. We want to thank our regular sponsor, Global Patties. Check them out at www.globalpatties.com. We also want to thank Strong Microbials, becoming the latest supporter of the podcast. Check out their probiotic line at www.strongmicrobials.com. And finally, we want to thank you, the Beekeeping Today podcast listener, for joining us on this show. Feel free to send us questions or comments to questions@beekeepingtodaypodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks a lot, everybody. Take care.